Orale! Bienvenidos and welcome to the Familia FFB podcast. I'm your host, Jorge Martin, and today we are going to the Pacific Northwest, the home of grunge, the former home of the Seattle Supersonics, but we're going to the place where the 12s are happening. The 12s, yes. We're going to the Seahawks, probably the loudest stadium in the NFL, a proud fan base, and bringing us inside is Mookie Alexander. So coming to us from fieldgoals.com and also SB Nation. And I got to tell you, Mookie, being a big Dodger fan, I love your name. So thank you very much for joining us. Thank you very much for joining us. Our right fielder that helped us win the World Series. Yes, very, very much. But thanks for joining us. I appreciate you. Muchas gracias.
Thanks for having me on. Yeah, whenever I see Mookie Betts' name pop up with some incredible highlight, me as a non-baseball fan, I go, yeah, you better believe I did that. I mean, I couldn't swing at the ball properly in T-ball, but he does absolutely marvelous things, especially when he's fielding. I mean, he is a special athlete. But you should thank the Red Sox. They didn't want to give him the money, and the Dodgers did, and they get a World Series out of it.
I'm still a little sore at the Red Sox for beating the Dodgers in 2018. And growing up a Laker fan, during the Showtime era of the 80s, I didn't love the Celtics fans very much. But I think all is well, and I'm very, very happy to have him for the next however many years, the next decade, and hopefully he keeps making those incredible. Yeah, I tell you, the plays that he makes in the field are actually more spectacular than what he does at the plate, and he's pretty incredible at the plate too. So
yes, he is.
Phenomenal. Yeah, I gotta know where did you get the name Mookie from?
The nickname actually came from a basketball player, Mookie Blaylock.
Yeah, Atlanta Hawks.
Yes, another famous Mookie. And of course, this Mookie Betts. So not Mookie Wilson from the Mets in the 86 Mets, but Mookie Blaylock, from the Atlanta Hawks. I think he played for the Warriors as well. But yeah, that nickname has stuck with me for going on 2+ decades.
I was actually wondering if it might have been either Blaylock or Wilson. So yeah, the basketball player. Yeah. Well, yeah, and Mookie Wilson is not too the other Mookie that's not too well liked in Boston after getting the hit in the 1986 World Series. So, some good and bad karma with Mookies for the Boston area. But we're in Seattle, and so we're talking Seahawks today. And this has been a team that's gotten, especially right after the Super Bowl. I mean, Dan Patrick has said many times how he watched Russell Wilson being in the owner's box, looking like, you know, someone ate his lunch, just looking completely unhappy. And he asked him about it. And, you know, some stuff came out that caused a little bit of an uproar. I mean, listen, it's a superstar quarterback says something that's newsworthy. It becomes a cycle unto itself. And then it gained new life. How was that for you, kind of covering the Seahawks, and how did the waters get calmed over time?
It was a bit of a nightmare because you don't want to lose your franchise quarterback. Now, for the most part, I was pretty confident that he would stay, but there I wasn't 100% confident because the Seahawks are known for making these absolute shocking moves from time to time with this management duo with John Schneider, the GM, and Pete Carroll, the head coach. But I figured it got smoothed over once Wilson seemed to get the offensive coordinator he desired, and then Shane Waldron, formerly the Los Angeles Rams. Now, we don't really know what his offense is going to look like until we actually see it in week one of the regular season. I'm not going to put any stock into the preseason because it's just going to be, you're not going to show your full hand. You're not going to have your full set of players as usual. But with Waldron, you look at the way the Los Angeles Rams operate their offense. They can go slowly, but they also can work very quickly. They can work in fast tempo. And that's what Wilson has been craving for years, and frankly, so have Seahawks fans, because really, the revelation of Wilson as a passer, I think, started in the back end of 2015 when the team was really in danger of missing the playoffs. They were 4-5. Their offense was very inconsistent, and the Legion of Boom started to show signs of cracking. But then Wilson just went on this tear that put him in dark horse MVP discussion. And one of the consistent things we found out of that offense under Darrell Bevell, then the offensive coordinator, is that the offense moved faster. Everything was in rhythm. And this past season with Brian Schottenheimer, it started well, started like everything was in rhythm. But then when defenses started to catch on, and frankly, the strength of schedule got tougher, teams could sit on a lot of the preferred route combinations and preferred play calls of the Seahawks. And when Wilson got out of rhythm, that basically shot the whole offense to pieces. So, yeah, the offensive line, I know, is a thing that Wilson has talked about. But to me, it's more of, I think he wants more control of how the offense is run. And the philosophical differences are clearly at play because Wilson, of course, wants to win this game, win games with his arm, with his arms, and then his legs secondarily at this stage of his career. Whereas Pete Carroll, we tend to know him as a guy who likes to run the ball a lot, control the game with a slow pace and dominant defense. Well, that defense isn't dominant anymore, and the run game is not as dominant as it used to be. And Wilson's been better as a passer than he was in the first couple of years of his career. So you want to build your offense around Russell Wilson and his strengths. And you want to have better receivers and better offensive line, better everything. But ultimately, the philosophical differences between Carroll and Wilson, I think, have been smoothed out so that there can be some sort of happy medium. Like, I don't think we're going to get a run-first offense this year. I think it would be silly to do that. But I don't think they're going to be as pass-heavy as they were last year because they had a very unusual season in terms of being proactively pass-heavy. All the other seasons where they're proactively pass-heavy, so really just 2016 and 17, either Russell Wilson was injured or the running game was so terrible that they couldn't rely on it whatsoever. So the let Russ cook mantra 2020 allowed Wilson to really flourish those first several weeks, but they tried to dial it back. They tried to run the ball more, but it just never got into the same flow again. So yeah, seeing Wilson at the Super Bowl and obviously upset that he's not the one there and Tom Brady gets to not only win another ring, but it's the way that Tampa Bay won it. He got sacked one time. And I know Wilson wanted Antonio Brown. I personally didn't, but Brown goes to the Buccaneers. He scores a touchdown in the Super Bowl. That had to have worked him at some point. But yeah, still, it's got to be eating at him to some degree, as it would any other top flight quarterback, to have won a Super Bowl, come within a yard of winning a second Super Bowl, and then just not really coming close to getting back. So your careers don't last forever. And Wilson, I'm sure, feels like this is the time, these next couple of years, to really make another push for the Super Bowl. And he might have really pushed management towards, hey, we need to make some moves that benefit me especially and benefit the team as a whole so that we can put ourselves in a better position to get back to the big game.
So he's really made a name for himself as a deep passer, and especially the past couple of years, the Rams have been very much a lot of motion, a lot of short passes with a lot of yards after the catch. Do you foresee a little bit of a mixture of the two when it comes to the passing game and Russ himself?
Oh, absolutely. I think the deep shots will still be there. Certainly. What we've learned out of training camp from players at the very least is that not all of the concepts from the Rams offense are going to be transferred over to the Seahawks. It's not going to be a pure cut and paste job. You're going to have some things that Wilson's familiar with from the Schottenheimer and Bevel days, and then you install what Waldron wants to run. And the yards after the catch, to me, that's a big deal because I think of it as hidden yards. And there are some receivers like Cooper Kupp and Robert Woods. They're excellent at getting yards after the catch. The Rams, under McVay, have been consistently one of the best teams in the league at getting yards after the catch. Under Brian Schottenheimer, the Seahawks have been one of the worst, both in yards after the catch and also broken tackles. So part of that is a personnel issue, but part of it, I think, is play calling and scheme, where there's going to be you're going to have plays where there's no chance of a broken tackle. It's when the pass is completed, those are the yards you get. Whereas with Waldron, I think we're going to see more motion, more unpredictability, more ways to space the offense out so that you can maximize the downfield abilities of DK Metcalf, Tyler Lockett, and others. So it certainly can unlock an element of this offense that we haven't really seen consistently ever in Seattle. I think the last good yards after the catch guy the Seahawks have truly had is Golden Tate. And that, to me, was a lot of it was his natural ability to break tackles in the open field. DK Metcalf can provide that. I think DK Metcalf, you put him in space more instead of just a primarily a deep ball option, Oh yeah, and realizing how quick he is. Look what he did in the 100-meter dash, running up against a world-class field of Olympic-caliber athletes. It would be terrifying for defenses. And also, Tyler Lockett, he's not as fast as he used to be, and you got to attribute that to the broken leg from 2016. But he's still quick. He has this unbelievable ability to get open 6-7 yards past the last defender. So I think for the Seahawks passing offense, if it's diversified and it can keep defenses guessing and they can keep the tempo going such that they can control it either by speeding it up at any given moment or slowing it down when they absolutely need to, there's every reason to think that from a skill position standpoint, the Seahawks should be one of the better offenses in the league. I mean, they have been for several years, but it's the process, I think, that's different. The process of previous Seahawks offenses, especially the early days, relied too much, I think, on Russell Wilson's improvisational skills. If this is more structured, it can save Wilson from getting hit so much, because that's been one of the other problems over the past few years. And it can get this offense into a more consistent rhythm.
That's awesome. You know, I was going to jump into the running backs, but let's, you know, since we talked about, you were talking about DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett, both of them very different season, you know, almost two halves to the season. DK Metcalf, both of them were among the, you know, the top receivers in the NFL from a fantasy point standpoint about the first half of the season. And then, you know, as you said, things got figured out. One question on each guy. What can we expect in DK Metcalf, who I think is a phenomenal talent, one of my favorite receivers in the game? He's going to year three, which where players can still be improving. What can we look for him there? And Tyler Lockett, you know, he had most of his touchdowns tied up into three games. Can we expect a more, you know, with this new offense, kind of a more consistent season out of him with still close to 100 receptions?
This will be interesting because you got to wonder, who is the number one receiver on this team now? Or is it 1A and 1B? And to me, that's not a bad problem to have at all. You have a 1A and 1B, two number one receivers. Lockett was clearly a number one receiver in 2018, and then as well as 2019. But 2020, you saw, yeah, Lockett had the 100 catches, but Metcalf, I think, had 80-some-odd catches. He had more receiving yards. And game to game, Metcalf ended up being more consistent because Lockett had a bit of a knee issue midseason. And this is the second year in a row that he's had some sort of injury where the productivity drop in the second half of the season was quite noticeable. So you got to think, though, that Lockett, he's never missed a game due to injury other than the broken leg season. So that would be 2016, and that was the last game of the regular season in the playoffs. Other than that, he is consistently available. With Metcalf, same thing. So with DK Metcalf, I think we're going to see him get more targets. The one thing he's got to clean up, though, the drops. He's had quite a few drops these first couple of seasons and very, very catchable passes, not difficult catches to make at all. I think a lot of it is concentration. But if he cleans up the drops, and everything we've seen out of Metcalf suggests that he is somebody who constantly strives for improvement, he could have a better year than he did in year two. Now, will that mean a drop-off statistically for Lockett? Perhaps, because then they could go to Metcalf more often. But with Lockett, you look at the 2018 season, not a lot of catches, I think 51, but he had 800-something yards and double-digit touchdowns on historic efficiency. So it's not great fantasy stats for 51 catches in a season, but if you like the touchdowns bit, then he's your guy. So he had, I think, 12, 13. He certainly had double-digit touchdowns last year. But as you said, concentrated in a handful of games. I think he had three against Dallas and three against Arizona in the road game. So that's six right there. So that's at least half of his touchdowns came in two games. One question mark, I think, for Shane Waldron's offense is, will the targets be spread out more often? And by that, I mean, will they go to the third receiver more or the fourth receiver? Are they going to incorporate tight ends better than we saw with Brian Schottenheimer, especially last year where they had Greg Olsen, Will Disley, and they just never, and Jacob Hollister, and they just never really got going consistently, and Olsen ended up getting hurt and retiring eventually. So with the 2021 team, Metcalf and Lockett are clearly the top two targets, but it's just how many more targets are going to be spread out to the other guys. And we can include the running backs too. Chris Carson, Rashad Penny, and whoever else makes the third running back and fourth running back spot. Because if it's a more spread out offense and there are weapons everywhere, so to speak, then we might see some statistical declines for Lockett, I think, not for Metcalf. But really, both of them should be viable fantasy options for the 2021 season because they're going to get the ball the majority of the time. And they're clearly the two best deep threats on the roster, too. Like the consistency that Wilson has throwing to Lockett, especially down the field, is it's really only rivaled by a handful of other quarterback wide receiver combinations. There's every reason to believe that's going to continue this year.
Well, let's go to the run. You touched on the running backs. Chris Carson came back on a free agent deal. Some people were thinking that might not happen. So, you know, we like to call on our show when someone has the bell cow role, the lead caballo. Can we look at more of that if he has a 17? You know, if he can make it through a 17 game season. I mean, he missed four games last year. He had one or two missing the year before, but with a healthy season, he's still in his prime. Are we looking at another solid season with maybe a little more work in the passing game too?
Yeah. Well, one of the things for Carson is you bring up this year's a 17 game season, which I don't really like. It just doesn't sound right. Every other sports has got an even number of games. 17 just sounds like a pure money grab. But for Carson, rookie year, breaks his ankle in the fourth game, out for the year. 2018, he misses a couple of games with ankle and hip injuries, I believe. 2019, he almost makes it through the whole season, and then he has a cracked hip in the second to last week of the regular season. And then in 2020, he misses time again with injuries. So the games missed is a little deceiving when you realize how serious that cracked hip was in 2019. But he just can't complete a full season. And the way he runs, it's such a punishing style. It makes you appreciate Marshawn Lynch that much more, that he could run the way he was able to run for years and not get injured all the time. But for Carson, his durability is not the greatest. I mean, he's not brittle, but he is certainly somebody who gets injuries that cause him to miss time virtually every season. In fact, definitely every season he's been in the league. But when he is healthy, he's a productive running back. He's never going to get you a 1,500-yard season. I mean, I think his biggest run last year might have been 30 yards. He's one to get you 15 yards, 20 yards, but he doesn't quite have that acceleration to really bust into the open field for long touchdown runs the way his backup Rashad Penny can. But one thing that Carson did improve upon last year was his ability to catch the ball. So his receiving statistics were the best of his career. He had, I think, four receiving touchdowns, including one on opening day against the Falcons last year on a screen pass, which the Seahawks consistently have struggled to operate successfully. Under Shane Waldron, if it's anything like the Rams offense, the screen game is going to be a major part of what the Seahawks could do and should do. And that'll allow Carson to get into the open field with blockers downfield. And if you're in a PPR league and you think that Carson's going to be able to get some targets, get a few catches in addition to what he can do on the ground, then he could be a sneaky later rounds addition, I would think.
Yeah, he's going off in the third round right now. And he is a guy, if somebody goes with the receiver or a tight end or maybe in a quarterback early, he seems to be one of those targets that I've been recommending a lot. Let's go to the tight end real quick. Gerald Everett coming over from the Rams with Shane Waldron. And Waldron worked with him as the tight ends coach for a period of time. So that relationship there has people really excited for Everett as a late round tight end. Could he be that third option in the passing game? Maybe, get a few more catches than Carson would?
I would lean towards Carson, but the one factor would be that Gerald Everett being that big bodied option for Russell Wilson, especially down the middle of the field. So you think of Jimmy Graham from 2015 to 2017 and how he was that big-bodied option for Russell Wilson, and it didn't really go as well as Seahawks fans had hoped with between Graham and the team and his productivity here. But Gerald Everett, he's a good tight end without being anything outstanding. he gets to be the clear tight end one on this roster, because when he was at the Rams, Tyler Higbee ended up being the preferred option. I think they will value Everett's contributions as a blocker, but statistically speaking, he's never really had something that would really get you excited about him as a pure receiving threat. But now that he gets to be the unquestioned number one, and frankly, with a quarterback upgrade, I think sensible people would agree Russell Wilson's better than Jared Goff. We might see Everett branch out and become a more viable receiving threat. But if you gave me the option of Everett or Carson, who's likely to produce better in terms of fantasy receiving numbers, I would lean towards Carson.
Wow, that makes me actually want to rank Carson even higher on my rankings. So awesome. Awesome. Jump over to the offensive line. And, you know, when we talked offline, you kind of had a little bit of a chuckle about the offensive line. Tell me, you know, this unit obviously had a little bit of a microscope put on it after what Russell said on Dan Patrick. How is this unit shaping up?
Well, there's one big development that's happening right now, and that's Dwayne Brown, the left tackle. And his contract is up after this season. He was never really going to compete in preseason anyway, because he doesn't need to at this age. But if this leads to him missing regular season games, then we've got a problem, because the tackle depth consists of Cedric Ogbuehi, and he's injured. So it's possible he might miss the start of the regular season. And then Stone Forsythe, awesome name, 6'9" rookie out of Florida, but he might be a little bit foot slow, and it's going to be hard for him to adjust to the NFL day one. So the Seahawks absolutely need Dwayne Brown out there week one against the Indianapolis Colts and then moving forward. So Brown, the rock of the offensive line, the best offensive lineman Seattle has. And then left guard is going to be Damian Lewis. Mikey Iupati retired last year. And Lewis had a really good rookie season playing at right guard. But they're moving him to left guard because Gabe Jackson was acquired via trade with the Las Vegas Raiders. So Jackson moves back to right guard. He was left guard in Vegas. So you get Lewis and Jackson and the interior line. And for me, I actually think that with the way Wilson plays, guard play is even more important than tackle play, because if he doesn't have any rushing lanes, then what's he going to do? Spin backwards? He doesn't have that speed anymore to do all those Houdini acts. He's just going to get sacked more often. So I'm pretty comfortable with the way that the guard positions are set. Center is another iffy spot, because Ethan Posick was re-signed in free agency on a one-year deal, but he's out with injury. So Kyle Fuller, the backup who started one game last year and it did not go very well, he's going to be starting this first preseason game and maybe the rest of the preseason. It's an open competition between Fuller and Posick. I know Seahawks fans were very eager to see this team finally go after a big name in free agency. Corey Linsley would be the biggest name as far as centers, but they didn't. I guess Austin Ryder is just still unsigned, so that would be one option if they don't like either the Posick or Fuller options per se. But right tackle, that's also a competition. Brandon Shell is the starter, but Cedric Ogbuehi, when he is healthy, was taking first-team snaps in training camp. So only really just Jackson and Lewis are set at their positions. Left guard or right guard are pretty set for week one. Brown, we got to see this resolved pretty soon. Center, we don't know yet. Right tackle, with the way he injured, it's probably Brandon Shell for now. But I don't think the offensive line was that bad last year, despite what Wilson said. It's just the odd timing of his comments, because there have been way worse offensive lines he could have called out. But last year, I felt that the injuries to the offensive line also made things worse. Like Posick got injured midseason. He had a concussion. Shell got injured as well. So I think Lewis had some nagging injuries too, and Iupati was consistently injured. So when the continuity was gone, I think it's not a coincidence that the offense started to fall apart a bit. So the offensive line, I think, should be good this year, as long as we get Dwayne Brown starting at left tackle and everything is done and dusted from that standpoint contractually. And whether it's Posick or Fuller, I think Posick should be the starter. Just to keep that continuity going there. He's nothing spectacular, but he's a solid pair of hands. They really need to work on the run blocking to me, and I think that's why they got Gabe Jackson, because the run blocking was not terrific last year, the way we saw in the early years when the Seahawks had a fearsome running game. But Gabe Jackson, not only very good in the passing game, but he's a real mauler in the run game. And he's like a serious upgrade to me over somebody who wasn't on the last year's roster, but DJ Fluker. So Gabe Jackson is a veteran presence. You won't see him making Pro Bowls all the time, but you don't need five All-Stars. You don't need five Pro Bowlers on your offensive line. You just need real good players. Dwayne Brown fits the bill, even at his age. Gabe Jackson does. Damian Lewis figures too. So that's three players right there. I think the offensive line should not be a serious issue pending two things. One, the status of Brown's contract, and two, just the health of everybody. Because we know in a backup offensive line, look what happened in the Super Bowl to even the great Patrick Mahomes. He got to experience what Russell Wilson has often experienced throughout his career, because Wilson has played through way too many backup offensive linemen, and games ended up looking exactly like that. And yet, it's because those Seahawks teams were so good that they didn't end up losing 31-9. But even the best quarterbacks, even the greatest escape artists, they have their limits when the tackles and the guards are turnstiles against great pass rushes.
You know what? It's funny. This has been a point of contention that I've had with a couple of friends of mine who are Seattle Seahawks fans, Greg Morrison and Edwin Porras, shouting you guys out here. But yeah, this is that, you know, just seeing Russ like running all over the backfield and then pulling off some miracle play. I mean, sometimes it's just I would just marvel at him. So just I know it's greatness that Seahawks fans, and I know they appreciate it. Let's go to the defensive side of the ball. One quick question on that. This was not a good unit, especially against the pass last year. I believe they were number 31 in passing yards allowed. Much better against the run, only number 5 in rushing yards allowed. Kind of, for me on Daily Fantasy, I really targeted whenever somebody was playing the Seahawks a lot, and I did okay on that one, and also on my own. On my own leagues, how does this unit kind of shape up for this season, especially considering the fact that Carroll is a defensive-minded coach?
Yeah, he's a defensive-minded coach, but this hasn't looked like a vintage Carroll defense. He's last, I would say, three seasons. 2018, that was the year Earl Thomas broke his leg, and that's the end of his Seahawks career. Mm-hmm. And from there, it was just kind of downhill. It was an inconsistent defense at best. 2019, more of the same. In fact, I would think they were mediocre against the pass and pretty poor against the run. It's just teams passed the ball so much against Seattle that the running stats, the basic running stats, looked a lot better because they just weren't running the ball a lot. But when you look at the more advanced stats, they were pretty poor against the run. 2020, significant upgrade against the run. They got better in the second half of the year against the pass, but there's an obvious asterisk to this. They played Carson Wentz, Dwayne Haskins, Colt McCoy, C.J. Beathard. Jared Goff ended up injuring his thumb in the middle of the game. So that's not a vaunt. And Sam Darnold, so it's a poor set of quarterbacks at best. So, of course, you're going to be able to beat up on those guys. And we're not really going to get a great sense of the Seahawks defense in week one either, because it looks like Wentz is going to be out and Jacob Eason or Sam Ellinger is going to be starting week one for the Colts. So the trend will continue. But I'm iffy on this defense, the secondary, specifically the cornerbacks. Shaquille Griffin went to the Jaguars in free agency, and Trey Flowers got injured and then eventually benched midseason for DJ Reed, who was one of the big finds of last offseason. They got him off of waivers, and he was supposed to be a nickel corner. He ends up being an outside corner at 5'9". Now, if you know anything about Carroll defenses, 6'2", 6'3", they like tall, rangy corners, long arms, but DJ Reed doesn't fit that mold. But he did a very good job as the second cornerback opposite Shaquille Griffin. So the number one cornerback figures to be Akella Witherspoon, again, going with the former 49ers. Reed, I think that's his job to lose. But against tougher defenses, they might have tougher offenses, rather. They might have a harder time. Now, the linebacker situation, it doesn't look like they're going to keep KJ Wright. He's still unsigned, and we're mid-August. It's hard to believe that he's unsigned given how good he's been. But such is life of an off-ball linebacker who doesn't rush the passer. There's just no value for them anymore in today's NFL. And it's sad because KJ is awesome. But Bobby Wagner, still going to be there. Jordan Brooks, KJ's replacement. I think he really impressed as a rookie. And he has that ability to go after the ball and go after tacklers. And he's a pretty fundamentally sound guy that he might be able to replace KJ effectively. But the depth after Wagner and Wright really not having me comfortable at all. I guess Daryl Taylor, who didn't play at all last season as a rookie, is going to be moved to linebacker. On the defensive line, interior, Brian Monet, Puna Ford, really good under the radar players. I think more people should know about Puna Ford, has significantly improved his ability to get after the quarterback. In addition to being a tremendous run stuffer, he can move well laterally. He can bust through offensive lines really well. On the edges, though, I think the key for Seattle and what made me happy is that after cutting him for cap reasons, they re-signed Carlos Dunlap. Now, they traded for him, and it changed the defensive scheme significantly because they didn't have to blitz as much. They didn't have to blitz Jamal Adams as much as they did to generate a pass rush, because when it was just four guys pre-Dunlap, they were getting nothing. But post-Dunlap, Dunlap ended up being the best pass rusher on the team by far. So you add Dunlap back into the fold. Alden Smith, I think that's a wait and see. He might not even make the team, and he's got a court case later this month for a battery charge down in Louisiana. Kerry Hyder Jr., another former 49er, another former Lion. He's been, you know, he's had a hard time staying healthy, but on a banged-up 49ers roster, he was one of their more productive players. He had a career year, so he could be a sneaky contributor on the Seahawks defensive line. But really, what saved the Seahawks last year was their ability to generate turnovers in the first half of the year. And then it died off in the second half of the year. I still think this is a team that can generate turnovers, but they're still probably not going to be a top 10 defense. Like if Jamal Adams and Quandre Diggs, that's a really good safety pairing. In fact, it's a great safety pairing, if you ask me. Wagner and Brooks, good linebacker duo. But everything else is just too many question marks for the Seahawks defense. And I certainly wouldn't rank them among one of the more talented defensive rosters in the league. And that speaks to just not drafting as well as they used to. Certainly, you don't get to draft Richard Sherman and Earl Thomas and KJ Wright and Bobby Wagner every single year. This isn't Madden. Sometimes you get great drafts. Sometimes you get not so great drafts, and some of the defensive picks, not so great. And that's why the Seahawks had to trade for Jamal Adams or Quandre Diggs over the past couple of seasons, because the players they did draft didn't cut the mustard. But if I was a daily fantasy guy picking the Seahawks defense and special teams, I would be wary just because of the points that they could give up, the yards that they could give up. One thing that should correct, they didn't have a defensive touchdown last year. Or a special teams touchdown. First time in franchise history. Normally they're good for a couple of seasons. I would like to think that changes this year.
Outstanding. So, you know, you've touched on a little bit of fantasy football. What's your favorite format to play?
Well, I've done it the traditional way for years, but now I got a keeper league going. And I'm digging it because I'm going to run the draft. The way my keeper league works is I think I got a roster of 12. But you can keep nine. So then you can choose three players in this year's draft. But to have a little dynasty going, I think that's pretty fun to do.
Oh, it's always fun to play GM that way. I mean, you're not just drafting. It's just, you're keeping players year to year. That's a blast. That's a blast.
Yeah, instead of starting over. And you know, starting over is just what the Detroit Lions do every year.
What's funny is I just had someone talk about the Detroit Lions, a fellow SB Nation writer, Mike Payton. In fact, that we released that today. So that was talk about timing. Last one. We're recording this on a Tuesday, Taco Tuesday in so many places. What are your favorite types and any place locally that you want to give a shout out to?
Oh, tacos. And yeah, you better believe that having lived in New York for 4 years and not really seeing a lot of Mexican eateries, being back on the West Coast since 2017, no joke, when I flew from New York to Portland, I arrived sometime afternoon. By the time I got to my hotel, I hadn't eaten anything since breakfast in New York. So the first place I went where my hotel was to a Mexican taco place. And I had the time of my life. Is just bringing back all the familiar flavors and tastes that I miss so much. Lengua tacos are my absolute favorite. Ooh. I love lengua tacos. Tripe tacos are good, but I also love I can't remember the name. The pork tacos, not carnitas. Not carnitas. The begins with an A. Al Pastor.
Not Al Pastor, right.
Yes, the Al Pastor tacos. And especially when you get the cilantro and onions mixed in, it's so flavorful. You don't need a whole lot. You don't need a whole lot. And as far as places out here where I am in the Portland area, there's a mixture supermarket and restaurant place out in a town called Hillsboro, which is where Intel is. It's called the Supermercado, I believe. And they sell everything from tacos to burritos, mojarra. I love the mojarra plates, but their tacos are fantastic because not only do you get the tamarindo or horchata or whatever drinks they have that day, but they also got jalapenos to go with that. And those are the spiciest things ever because they get them fresh off the grill. So shout out to them. And also there's a little food truck in a city called Beaverton, which is where Nike is. And a lot of taco trucks out in this area. So anybody in the Portland area or wants to go to the Portland area, you're not short of Mexican options. But it's a place called, I think, Mama Chia, C-H-I-A, or Chio, C-H-I-O. And very cheap tacos and burritos, highest quality. And the burritos are so large. And they also add some, their specials add some bell peppers in there. It's top of the line stuff. And that's what I love about tacos and burritos in general. You're going to get a full meal. It's not going to cost you an arm and a leg. You can just sit down and enjoy it. And their nachos are fantastic. I mean, it's a taco truck that operates from when I was last there physically. I've been, of course, ordering in these last several months. They're based out of a gas station. I mean, the laws out here are very liberal in terms of where you can have taco trucks and other food places, other food stands. So all the taco trucks flourish out here. So you give me a couple of Al Pastor, a couple of asada, and a couple of lengua tacos, and I'm good for lunch and dinner. Especially with the salsas. These salsas, as somebody who loves spicy food, as I just mentioned, the grilled jalapenos, the spicy salsas are just, oh, man. It's got me hungry just thinking about it. And we're in the middle of a heat wave. I'm already just ready to have just blazing hot food, but it's so flavorful, so delicious.
Well, you know, wash it down with a beer or something, some other cold beverage, and that's a nice balancing act. I tell you, gotta love that. Gotta love that. Oh, Mookie. Esto fue un gran placer. I really appreciate this. Plus, it's also making me hungry since we're both on the West Coast. It's dinner time out here. Please share with our audience where they can find your great work.
Thank you. So you can find me on Twitter at Mookie Alexander, and I write for Field Goal, fieldgoals.com. And also, if you're an MMA and boxing fan, UFC and boxing fan, I'm an associate editor over at bloodyelbow.com. So you can find my combat sports work there, my football stuff at Field Goals, and thanks for having me on. Muchas gracias.
And I love saying your name again, Mookie Alexander. Just love saying your name because, again, Mookie Betts. Everybody, familia, eso es todo for our show. Special thanks to Anchor and for YouTube for putting our content out there for both audio and video side. Please make sure to subscribe at YouTube. And also you can subscribe at Apple, Google, Spotify, wherever you can get your podcasts. Also, you can find original content at familiaffb.com. You could find me at JorgeMartin17 on Twitter, and also go to @familiaffb on Twitter and Instagram. And also check us out on Facebook. Otra vez, Mookie, can't thank you enough. Un millón de gracias. And everybody, todos somos familia. Salud.